Okay, so this is the lecture in week 7. Jess tells me that she's hoping to have the essays marked. Not, this is a different group we're talking about, isn't it, Jess?
Yeah.
Sorry, no, don't worry. Your essays are all now due in on Monday, as I hope you all got that message through my error. Lovely error. Saves us all. Your blog marks, I'm working on them, but just let me tell you that I'm having great difficulty getting through them all because I've got four different groups, all doing blogs. But you will get your 5 marks for your first view soon. It's all happening soon. Next week, in the unit outline, we move on to modernism, modernist texts. So the list of readings there in your anthology are all there on page 4 of your unit outline. And then, hooray, we all have a vacation week. We ought to catch up with our lives. I know it's pretty intense for all of us at the moment.
It means you all have the chance to actually read Faulkner in that vacation.
That's right.
Yeah. The whole novel.
It's not long. As I Lay Dying. Yeah, you get a chance to read that. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about anything? Any questions? No? Good. All right. Okay, well, today, the two Roberts, an odd collection of poets. I mean, the reason when I was constructing this course a few weeks back, trying to work out what would come after the African Americans, the two Roberts popped into my mind because they're both brilliant poets. I've had a passion for Robert Frost for many years, and I love Robert Lowell for different sorts of reasons, and it just seemed impossible to do an American Lit course without referring to these two poets in some kind of depth. They're very different, and they come from very different periods of American history, American literary history. Robert Frost didn't see any war action. He was in Europe when the First World War, he heard of the First World War starting, and he immediately went back to America and shortly thereafter bought a farm in New Hampshire. So Frost's relationship to war was minimal. He managed to kind of escape that. We know that the Americans did get eventually involved in the First World War to the end of the war, but to begin with, America was sort of standing back, holding its hands behind its back. So he really exemplifies the first half of the 20th century in poetry. And he was a very traditional poet as well, although he was experimental in his themes, and he was a very original poet. I mean, he wouldn't have become the poet that he was if he hadn't really brought something new to the world. I'm sure most of you probably have heard about President Kennedy, who got shot. Well, Robert Frost was invited to read a poem at President Kennedy's inauguration. We have the poem in our anthology. It's The Gift Outright. So that was a huge kind of stepping stone for any poet to be invited in that way. Robert Lowell was very involved in war and very involved in the whole question of African-American relations in America. The poem that I want to finish this lecture on, and I'm going to make sure I allow at least 15 or 20 minutes for it, is For the Union Dead, which we're going to spend a bit of time in tutorials on today as well. And For the Union Dead is a tribute to the general who took the only corps of black African American soldiers to fight the Confederates down in the South against slavery. And it was a butcher's job. The general was killed, and most of the black Africans were killed as well. But there is a memorial to that event in Boston where Lowell lived. And For the Union Dead is, quite an amazing poem in its the sorts of questions it raises about where is America now for all the Civil War. And the poem actually alludes at one point to Lowell watching a television show and seeing all these black faces of young children down in the South still marginalized, segregated, not having any real chance in life. So that's Robert Lowell's contribution to the whole question of war and social justice and so on. Robert Frost doesn't really get into social justice in that way. Robert Frost is a much more kind of lyrical, personal, almost nature poet, except that Robert Lowell gets into the kind of dark areas of the human psyche, fears particularly about death. And that's where I suppose Robert Lowell and Frost somehow meet in the middle, because Robert Lowell is also very fearful and conscious of death. That comes through in his poetry fairly strongly. But coming back to Robert Lowell and war, Robert Lowell was brought up in a very conservative family in New England, in Boston, and his parents and his grandparents all had affiliations with soldiery and war. And it was during the Second World War that Robert Lowell decided to be a conscientious objector, and he was thrown into jail in New York, West Street. Those of you that are coming to New York with me in January, you might go and visit the jail in West Street, where Robert Lowell met some of the most infamous gangsters, mafia gangsters, in that jail. There's his wonderful poem called Memories of West Street and Lepke. And Lepke was a real thug. He was part of a company called Murder Incorporated. But Lowell was jailed for that. And then Lowell was also vehemently against the Vietnam War. So Lowell had a lot of anger against America's involvement in war around the world. He'd have a lot to say nowadays, I'm sure. Both poets interest me for the way that they relate to questions of religion. Now, it's said that Robert Frost was completely a-religious, that he didn't have any religion at all and didn't kind of follow any religion. Well, that might be the case, but his poetry certainly reaches into areas of silence. There's that famous line from T.S. Eliot, which I quoted every drop of the hat. T.S. Eliot in his poem The Four Quartets. T.S. Eliot's also an American poet, and we're not doing him in this course. He's probably bigger than Robert Frost, but we're not doing him. But T.S. Eliot wrote, "Words reach into the silence." And that was a poet's attempt to express the nature of poetic language, that poetic language really does take us beyond literally translating the world around us and describing our emotions and feelings and our experiences. Poetry is on the edge of reaching into something that is beyond words, beyond explanation. There's a famous medieval book called The Cloud of Unknowing. It's by an unnamed priest of the 14th century. And what The Cloud of Unknowing is a book about how the only way to wisdom is to let go of everything in your mind, to let go of all your brain contents, and enter into the cloud of unknowing. And T.S. Eliot kind of picks that up in the line, "Words reach into the silence." Poetic words take us into areas of experience that are beyond easy rational description. Now that's a prelude to Robert Frost, because Robert Frost's poetry often takes us to the edge of silence. And what is it that Robert Frost meets there? Well, it's not God with a capital G. Sometimes it's fear with a capital F. But quite often it's something that, you know, that I use the word ineffable. Ineffable. Ineffable is kind of beyond rational description. Ineffable. Robert Frost seems to like to go there and seems to almost want to go there, to go somewhere where some kind of new understanding is born in him. So, you know, I think it's wrong to say that there's nothing religious in Robert Frost, that he's just a nature poet. I think there is something there. There's a kind of a hungering for an alternative awareness of reality. It comes through in his poetry. Maybe that's why people have been attracted to his poetry, because it kind of touches on these questions that many in the people in the 20th century have turned their backs on religion. They still find something that's nourishing and nurturing in the way that Robert Frost addresses reality. Robert Lowell is very different. Robert Lowell was a committed Catholic, or rather, he converted to Catholicism early in his career and wrote a lot of very highly ornate Catholic poetry, like The End of the Quaker Grave at Yard at Nantucket, which is a tribute to the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of Walsingham, one of the great religious shrines in England. And he was trying through traditional religious practice and then also through very traditional religious forms in his early verse to approach religious truth formally. And then he threw it all away. He couldn't cope with it, and he had a very difficult life, did Robert Lowell. He was, some people say he was bipolar. He spent many periods of life in mental hospital. And he had very, very difficult relationships with his partners. He had three wives, and every marriage of his was a failure, obviously. Otherwise he wouldn't have had three of them, would he? So he had a very complex personal life. And after he turned away from Catholicism, he's most famous for what has come to be called confessional poetry. Ironically, we associate the confession with Catholicism, but by the time he was writing his confessional poetry, he'd certainly turned his back on Catholicism. But what Lowell was doing, he was using poetry to excavate his own internal psychology, his own inner experience, excavate it. And he turned a kind of a sharp lens on his inner life, almost painfully so. Some of his poems are almost hard to read. They're so, you know, so sharply about his painful emotions and sicknesses and what have you going on. Confessional poetry. He was partly stimulated to do this by the beat poets in the 1950s in California. Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti, Jack Kerouac, and so on. They were all beginning to write a poetry that was much freer than traditional verse and was also very much about their own personal experience of the world and their hatred of what was happening in the world politically. The beat poets. So Robert Lowell kind of got his clue from them. He wasn't a beat poet by any means, but he kind of got his direction for turning poetry onto himself. So a lot of Lowell's poems are confessional poems. But the poem I started off with talking about at the lecture today, For the Union Dead, which is about, you know, the Civil War, or rather it's a reflection on the Civil War, and it's a reflection on a statue that sits in Boston. You can actually go and see it now, which is a statue to that general who took the only black group of soldiers to the war down south. That poem is partly confessional, but it's really more political. So, you know, poetry is kind of, his poetry is turning back to the outer world. So, talking about Robert Frost's toying with experience that takes you beyond the framework of everyday reality, one of Robert Frost's poems that does that most compellingly is one of his most famous poems, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, which we're going to look at in tutorials today, so I don't want to exhaust any commentary on it right now. But just to read it, it's such a very simple poem, simple in its language, so different in its language to early Robert Lowell. It's amazing. And it raises sorts of questions about how poetic language works. You know, poets, one poet can use many, many different kinds of language, and that's very obvious in Robert Lowell. But there's such different language between poets as well. And, you know, my favorite metaphor about poetry, which is a bit rough, but it sort of works sometimes, is that poetry can either be opaque or transparent. You know, opaque poetry, like early Robert Lowell, like Francis Webb in Australia, is opaque because the words, you've got to look up every word, you can't kind of get the connections between the words. And most people will turn away from it and say, it's not for me. But if you wrestle with it, deal with it, the opacity gradually gives way and you begin to see how there's so much contained in these metaphors, in these images, in these rhythms, opaque poetry. And in contrast to that, there is poetry which is transparent, so that when you read the poem, you can see the meaning straight through it. There's no difficulty with any of the words. The meaning is very clear. But that's a very crude kind of differentiation, because when you come to a poem like Robert Frost's Stopping by Woods at the Snowy Evening, there's no difficult words. It's very simple. There are repeated words and phrases. And at the end of it, you're left wondering, well, what is that really about? How are these simple words kind of pointing beyond themselves? So, you know, even transparent poetry can have depths to it. That's the nature of poetic language. Here's Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Now, many people, when you read that poem to them, they will say they like it, and you ask them, why do they like it? And they say, well, it's just got something haunting about it. It's just got something, you know, what is it? People who perhaps even don't read poetry very often, they might be triggered into something by just hearing that. And it's, you know, it's looks so simple, and it's very formal and traditional in its rhyme scheme. But there's some oddities about it, and that's the sort of thing I'd like to discuss in tutorials. But I want to take this opportunity to play you just a little bit about where we can actually watch Robert Frost speaking to an audience of very excited young girls. He's, you know, quite old at this point. And there's a two-part video. I've put the links up for you there. We'll look at another part a bit later on. It's called A Lover's Quarrel with the World. A Lover's Quarrel with the World. That's the title of the film, A Lover's Quarrel with the World. And it makes sense when you read quite a few of Robert Frost's poems that, you know, he's certainly in love with creation and in love with what's around him, but there's also this edge of critique about the way things go in the world. Let's see if I can get this happening. Just check speakers first. Yep, speakers are all right. And now with a bit of luck, I should be able to just click on here and go in there.
Just fold your set. best way to settle them is to make something that has form, because all you want to do is get a sense of form. All that makes you healthy and well is a feeling that there is some sort of form to your business, your occupation. Everybody that starts anything just starts as a village idiot, of course. And maybe that's what all poets ought to be. You know, you see them wondering about that, how wild you have to go to be beyond the rational, you know, beyond the orderly. I often think that where the thought comes in, the force comes in, the wild force. My friendship lately in Washington has been very strange to me. It's blundered into, and I'm very much in the affairs of the Secretary of in the Interior. That doesn't mean psychology. Real interior. And his beautiful obsession is almost the same as mine. Mr. Udall is round everywhere declaring wildernesses. It's he and Daniel Boone and Thoreau and me. All for the wilderness. Another poet had that wish, you know. Oh, he said, oh, for a lodge in some vast wilderness. 18th century poet said, oh, for a lodge in some vast wilderness. Some mighty contiguity of shade. He got that, some 18th century stuff. mighty contiguity of shade. That's fun, isn't it, that way? You know, we're taught that they're going to change change swords into plowshares, you know, and all that, change weapons into tools. This one is called the objection to being stepped on. This is a recent one, too. The objection to being stepped on. At the end of the row, I stepped on the toe of an unemployed hoe. It rose in offense and struck me a blow in the seat of my sense. It wasn't a blame, but I call it an aim. And I must say it dealt me a blow that I felt like malice prepense. You may call me a fool, but was there a rule the weapon should be turned into a tool? But what do we see? The first tool I step on turned into a weapon.
Okay, you can watch the rest of that in your own time. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. So we come back here. So in Robert Frost's, you've got a little essay on Robert Frost at the end of your collection of poems. It's on page 250 in your text. It's called The Figure a Poem Makes. And one of the sentences in there is the one that I've got on the screen there. A poem begins in delight and ends in wisdom. It runs a course of lucky events and ends in a clarification of life. It's a beautiful quote. It applies to stopping at woods in the snowy evening. It applies to many of Robert Frost's poems. The poem draws you in with the interest of its subject. It runs through various arguments and images and so on. But at the end of it, a poem... Could you please, at the back, you guys, pay attention? And I don't know what you're doing at the back there, but, you know, whatever it is, please attend, okay? Conversations in the back are very distracting. Thank you. So it runs the course of lucky events and ends in a clarification of life. So what does that mean? What does that mean to anybody? Anybody think they've got some understanding of what that could mean? Ends in a clarification of life. Any thoughts? How can a poem end in a clarification of life? Yep, Anthony?
It sort of makes sense of the human experience.
Good. Makes sense of the human experience. And Robert Frost's poems are very much about human experience. Some of his poems are like little dramas. He loves these poems that are like conversations between a man and a wife about something that's really disturbing them in their life. And the poem comes through to some kind of closure at the end, some new understanding. So why has he written that poem? Well, he's obviously trying to clarify something in his own life, but by reading it and engaging it, it clarifies something in our life as well. I mean, all literature in some way changes the way we see ourselves and the way we see our world. Some great novelist whose name I can't remember said, every great novel changes your life. I don't know whether that's true for you or not. Maybe you'll find that out. There are quite a few other key ideas in this essay that one could spend a lot of time on. Robert Frost says in the second paragraph on page 251, for instance, about his own writing of poetry. For me, the initial delight is in the surprise of remembering something I didn't know I knew. It's a really interesting idea about writing in general, even when you're writing an essay. To write is to discover something that, you know, is kind of fleetingly there in your mind. And then it comes into reality as the words come on the page. Perhaps this is even more true of a poem. He continues, I am in a place, in a situation, as if I had materialized from cloud or risen out of the ground. There is a glad recognition of the long lost, and the rest follows. Step by step, the wonder of unexpected supply keeps growing. The impressions most useful to my purpose seem always those I was unaware of, and so made no note of at the time when taken. So he's saying something very important here about the creative process, that the creative process comes from a different area to our conscious mind. I'm just reminded here, some of us had the fortune of hearing David Malouf last year talking about his fiction here, and someone asked him in the audience, you know, do you plan your novels? Do you work out a plot before you write them? He said, no, I just allow the characters to grow and they dictate to me and tell me where they want to go. So there's a real sort of awareness here of how the creative process is not something we can kind of shackle with our rational mind. It's something that comes through a different part of ourselves and can then surprise us with a new insight about our own experience. So with Robert Frost particularly, I mean, these are just, you know, these are guidelines I'm sure you've heard before. How do I attune myself to listen, to hear, to see, to understand what the mysterious language of poetry has to offer me? Robert Frost is a good poet to use for this whole area of trying to understand something that is beyond ordinary rational thought. You know, some poets are so difficult, you know, it's very hard to give advice how to deal with it. You have to look things up first, and then once you know the context, you can allow this something else to kind of come through into you. I open to a general impression. I don't try to understand with my ordinary mind. I read, I listen, I allow the poem to sound in me just like a piece of music does. This is another one of my favorite analogies. One is the opaque and the transparent, but you know, I often have students asking me, well, why didn't, if the poet means that, why didn't they just say that? And the question, of course, is whatever you say ever adequate to what the poet is really trying to convey? And the analogy I often use is like a piece of music. You know, when you go and listen to a concert, listen to the New World Symphony by Dvorak, for example. You hear all this stuff, you feel inside all these various emotions, etc. But at the end of it, if somebody asks you, what does it mean? You can't say what it means, but you know you've experienced it. The same thing applies in many ways to poetry. It's a bit of a different art form because the words in a poem are not like the notes in a piece of music. You can't kind of say what a crotch it is. It's just a black dot with a line on it. But you can say what snow is. Snow is something that falls down from the sky in winter. So there are all sorts of connotations that come with that. But the overall effect of a poem in its rhythm, in its sound patterning, in its imagery, has a quality that's like music. And so, you know, one thing to note when you're reading a poem, particularly one by Robert Frost, is to see the patterns of meaning, the patterns of sound, repeated sentence patterns. It's a bit like looking at a painting sometimes. You know, in the gallery we go and we look at, say, that painting that some of us looked at recently, the Arthur Streeton painting, Fires on Lapston Tunnel. And, you know, you begin to read the red flag in the middle and the red Waratahs up on the left and the red earth down the bottom. And you begin to connect things. There are patterns in there that help you to make sense of, you know, the meaning of the painting. So, for example, in a companion poem, well, not really a companion poem, in another poem by Robert Frost, written a few years later to Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, in fact, in 1936, 13 years later, he wrote a poem called Desert Places. It's also about snow falling. It's very interesting to compare Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening with Desert Places. Poems about similar subjects, except in desert places, the cart horse is gone, the familiar environmental details have gone. You're up against something that's perhaps more, almost more beyond understanding. So let's read the poem on page 246. Snow falling and night falling fast. Oh, fast, in a field I looked into going past, and the ground almost covered smooth in snow, but a few weeds and stubble showing last. The woods around it have it is theirs, all animals are smothered in their lairs. I am too absent-spirited to count, the loneliness includes me unawares. And lonely as it is, that loneliness will be more lonely ere it will be less. A blanker whiteness of benighted snow, with no expression, nothing to express. They cannot scare me with their empty spaces between stars, on stars where no human race is. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. So the poem seems to move from this landscape out to a cosmic landscape, and then back into his own internal world, a little bit like that Canadian film I was telling you about the other day, about the chap sitting on a boat in a lake. Was it this class I was telling it to? I think it was. So if you're looking for patterns in this poem, you might note in what I've got on the screen here, snow falling and night falling. Fast, oh fast, in a field I looked into going past, and the ground almost covered smooth in snow, but a few weeds and stubble showing last. The woods around it have it is theirs, all animals are smothered in their lairs. I am too absent-spirited to count, the loneliness includes me unawares. And lonely as it is, that loneliness will be more lonely ere it will be less. A blanker whiteness of benighted snow, with no expression, nothing to express. They cannot scare me with their empty spaces between stars, on stars where no human race is. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. And I mean, I've just highlighted by colour there some of the patterning in their falling and loneliness that really is a key and a clue to the kind of inner psychological experience that this poem is tracking through in its presentation of this unfathomable landscape. Well, Robert Frost is perhaps most famous for the poem that this image accompanies. Does anybody know what this image, what poem this image accompanies? Anybody guess? The Road Less Taken. The Road Not Taken. Not The Road Not Taken. I've tried to group Robert Frost's poems. One grouping is poems that have got some philosophical or didactic purpose. Didactic is a purpose of that teaches you something. The word didactic is a horrible word for me. I must just share with you one personal memory. When I was in the last year of high school in Australia, I'd just come to Australia, I had an English teacher. I think the only word he ever knew was didactic. Everything was didactic. I didn't understand what the word meant. Shakespeare, all the poetry he did, didactic, didactic. Bloke drove me mad. I looked it up since then, and I found out what didactic means. It means trying to teach you something. And I think that Robert Frost, in part of him, was a teacher. He was using his own experience to present something that could show us lesser mortals how to deal with our life. And some of you probably know there is a book written by Peck, Scott Peck, called, is it called The Road Not Taken? I think it's actually, that's the title. The Road Less Travelled. The Road Less Travelled, which I think quotes this poem somewhere near the beginning of it, a psychology book that helps people make sense of their lives and tries to suggest that people should take not the conventional path but the unconventional path, and that way true happiness lies. So this is The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay. In leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by. And that has made all the difference. Why has it made all the difference? Why would taking the road less travelled make all the difference?
It's unknown.
Unknown, unconventional, yep.
New eyes, new experiences.
New eyes, new experiences, yep, Charles? You didn't have your hand up?
No, but I had the question of say you're actually exploring things that no one else has probably seen before.
That's it, that's perfect. Exploring things that no one else has seen before, not going down the conventional path. We all have those junctures in our life. Should I go this way or should I go this way? So it's a neat poem and dramatizes beautifully the kind of uncertainties of life and the way that we are led certain ways that sometimes make a real difference. One of the most attractive things about Robert Frost is the rhythms in his poetry. And when you read a lot of Robert Frost, it's very conversational, and yet it all carries a music that's unmistakably Robert Frost. If you hear records of Robert Frost's poetry, you'll get that taste. He just has his own music. He's developed his own music. And it comes through in a lot of his poems. The one I'm going to read now is Birches. And it's one of a number of kind of beautiful nature poems, particularly reflecting on his life as a child in the woods. And at the same time, like The Road Not Taken, it contains within it a kind of a wisdom that's grown of reflection on his childhood and reflection on in comparison with the adult world. Now, birches, something we don't get in Australia, birches are very thin, well, they don't have to be thin, a very old one could be thick, I suppose, but young birches, you get birch forests, thin stems, and they're very, very bendy, and they've got black and white stems on them. And of course, where Robert Frost lived in the winter time, they become coated in ice. So, you know, when they in a forest, they click against each other. It's quite a, he really kind of builds up a beautiful image of this birch forest with its ice-covered bark and the way the ice breaks off it in the wind. But most significantly in this poem, he describes what happens when a young boy climbs up these birches. What happens then? So it's, you know, from one point of view, it seems to be a poem about something so mundane, childhood experience. How can he turn something that's, you know, sort of so unprepossessing, it's not like Robert Lowell's For the Union Dead or anything like that, but he turns it into a wonderful sort of reflection on the nature of nature, childhood experience, and what can be learnt through that. Birches. And the other thing I want to say too is that as we read through it, it sometimes seems so conversational, as if he's following his own thoughts, a little bit like what he was describing in the essay, the sentence in the essay that I read from, where he talks about, for me, the initial delight is in the surprise of remembering something I didn't know I knew, and the impression most useful to my purpose seems always those I was unaware of and so made no note of at the time. And the poems almost seem to have been written in that way, like written out of thoughts that just came into his mind, impressions that just came into his mind. He's obviously reflecting about the past. He's obviously written and rewritten these poems to make them so formally effective. No poet could write, you know, with such rhythmic accuracy straight off. Those of you that are writing poetry in your blogs, which I'm seeing at the moment, you know, sometimes you need to go back and write it and rewrite it and rewrite it until it flows, until it has a kind of a, the rhythm has a relationship to the meaning. Some of you think you just write a poem and throw it out there and it's brilliant straight away. Not so. You know, Robert Frost and great poets have rewritten and rewritten and rewritten until it flows. And yet, the poem has got this sense of a conversational fluidity about it. It reminds me a little bit of the conversation poems that were written in the Romantic period by people like Coleridge and Wordsworth, poems that have got that freshness of everyday language, everyday experience. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many coloured as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel of the ice. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. A beautiful image. You know, beautiful kind of observing something so simple in nature, the ice cracking on a tree when it's being moved by the wind. And then he says, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. It's kind of a miraculous line, really. turned something ordinary into something, you know, quite extraordinary. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once they're bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. This is a poet who's, you know, finding an extraordinary comparison. Here are these trees that have been bowed down by snow, and they look like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storms, I should prefer to have some boy bend them. So he's kind of, in this poem, he's actually commenting on his own the fact that he was distracted from his original thought, where he was talking about boys bending birches, and suddenly Truth broke in, because he suddenly began to think about the ice and the snow and what happened to the trunks of the tree with the ice on it. I was going to say, when the Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storms, well, he's being a bit coy when he says all the matter of fact. You could hardly think that the inner dome of heaven is matter of fact. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storms, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself. Summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He's describing a hypothetical child who's bending all the birch trees in his father's forest. Maybe this is him too. Maybe he's talking about himself. Notice how the sentence finishes in the middle of the line. Notice how it's so conversational, and yet there's this pulsing rhythm all the way through. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, first feet with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches. So he's bringing himself fully into the picture here. He's drawing on his own memory. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood. Here you've got his image of woods, you know, being in a pathless wood and the road not taken. It's when I'm weary of considerations and life is too much like a pathless wood, where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it to open. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. So he's romanticizing here about being in a birch forest, having the excitement and the exaltation of being a child and up in a birch tree. What's this reminding of you, by the way? What's it reminding you of within American literature that we've studied so far?
Emerson.
Yes, Emerson, Thoreau, the transcendentalists are coming clearly through Robert Frost here. I'd like to get away from earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. So he's very earthed. He'd like to get away from earth a while, but he hopes that no one's listening and is going to take him seriously, because he's affirming and confirming his own connection with earth, the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. It's wonderful. And it brings all sorts of, well, what does he mean? What's the metaphoric significance of being a swinger of birches? What are the connotations that kind of draws in? It's just beautiful. It kind of very open-ended in its suggestion that you know, you need to get away for a while and touch heaven and come back to earth, and it's raising all sorts of questions about the relation of heaven to earth and so on. Tether it. That's right. There's so many good poems here, it's hard to know which way to go with these ones with a philosophical or didactic purpose. But I think it's worth having a look at directive. It's one of the last poems here. And yeah, I've got time, I think. The poem, the title Directive, directive actually means instructions or directions. So it is a very didactic poem. It's kind of giving us instructions on how to deal with life experience, what to do with life experience. And it's sort of very different from Birch's, because it's describing a real landscape. But it's probably describing it far more metaphorically than the Birch's poem. In the Birch's poem, and in a wonderful poem like After Apple Picking, which has a similar kind of texture to the Birch's, he likes to say very close to the immediate natural environment. But in Directive, the whole thing becomes much more a kind of a metaphorical journey. And the poem is a reflection on how things in our life get destroyed and disappear, and what sense can we make of our life when things kind of disintegrate? How can we relate to the inevitable transience of everything in our life? Everything just passes. How can we deal with that? And the poem is like a journey through uncharted space, and the poem is kind of full of advice as to how we should deal with that. And it was written. What is the last poem in our collection? So it's probably one of the last poems that he wrote. So let me read it and make a few comments as we go through. It's on page 248. Back out of all this now, too much for us. Too much for us. So he's here commenting on just the weight of things that have to be dealt with. Back now, back out of all this now, too much for us. Back in a time made simple by the loss of detail, burned, dissolved, and broken off like graveyard marble sculpture in the weather. There is a house that is no more a house, upon a farm that is no more a farm, and in a town that is no more a town. So he's describing like visiting an old gold mining town that's all disappeared. But it's, in a way, it's kind of metaphorical, because he's asking us to go back in a time where the details have kind of disappeared. And the next line shows us that he's kind of taking us into a kind of a psychological or metaphysical space. The road there, if you let a guide direct you, who only has at heart you're getting lost, may seem as if it should have been a quarry, great monolithic knees, the former town long since gave up pretense of keeping covered. So the road to this place, this hypothetical place, he's going to guide us there, but he's a guide whose only role is to get us lost. Now, Stopping by Woods at Snowy Evening is a poem that, in a sense, takes us to the edge of getting lost. What does it mean? A lot of his poetry is taking us to the threshold of what we know, wanting us to take us beyond what we know into a place where there's a different kind of understanding. And he's here gone back to the landscape where all the town is gone, and all you see is the rock that was underneath the town, the great monolithic knees. And there's a story in a book about it. Besides the wear of iron wagon wheels, the ledges show lines ruled south, east, north, west, the chisel work of an enormous glacier that braced his feet against the Arctic Pole. So there's a book written about this town and about its geology. And this town goes, this place goes back so far in history that you can see the scratch marks of the Ice Age, thousands, millions of years ago. You must not mind a certain coolness from him, still said to haunt this side of Panther Mountain. Panther Mountain, incidentally, is in the Catskills Mountain, just north of New York. Everything that you find both in Robert Lowell and in Robert Frost, you look it up on your Google, and you'll find all the landscapes and the details and pictures and what have you. Reading poetry for your generation is so much easier than reading poetry for my generation. When I first read this poetry, I couldn't make head nor tail of a lot of it. You had to rush into the Fisher Library and dig out the encyclopedias. But nowadays, you just pick this bloody little thing up here and put Panther Mountain for me to get a picture of it. Nor need you mind the serial ordeal of being watched from 40 cellar holes as if by eye pairs out of 40 firkins. Whoa, it's weird. So in this town, there are all these potholes, holes that look as if you're being looked at by pairs of eyes out of 40 firkins. And a firkin is a small wooden tub for butter or lard. But that's what it looks like to him. These little holes in the ground everywhere, probably the holes where the buildings had their posts in. As for the woods' excitement over you, that sends light rustle rushes to their leaves, charge that to upstart inexperience. So he's obviously traveling through woodland. There's forests around there. And he's sensing the excitement of the leaves being moved by the light and the wind above his head. The forests are kind of being personified here as alive around him. Where were they all not 20 years ago? So 20 years ago, they weren't there at all. So he's obviously describing a journey back to somewhere where he's been 20 years ago. They think too much of having shaded out a few old pecker-fretted apple trees. So back in his memory, the place was full of apple trees and they're all shaded out now. Make yourself up a cheering song of how someone's road home from work this once was, who may be just ahead of you on foot or creaking with a buggy load of grain. So, you know, when we go down to, ghost towns like some of the ghost towns out west here. What's the name of a ghost town? Somebody tell me the name of a ghost town. It's at the back, it's at the tip of my tongue, but not far enough forward. Out past Mudgee, out past there. Come on, you're my brain's trust.
You are breathing.
Sorry?
You are breathing.
I've never heard of that one. I wonder, really, one we have all heard of. What's the one that everybody goes and visit? Past Sofala.
Oh, it's on the tip of my
tongue. So what is it?
Camden?
No, not Camden.
Are you talking about a ghost, like a town of ghosts?
There's like a bunch of dead people.
Town of ghosts is Big Den.
Yeah, I was thinking
of Pigton.
Yeah,
with crazy. Sorry, Hilland, David. Thank you very much. Bag of Smarties for you. Hilland, no Smarties for anybody else. Hilland. Now, if you go down to Hilland, if you're walking through Hilland, of course you imagine what it must have been like. You know, actually, in that case, maybe 80-100 years ago, what carts were travelling down that road. What were the people like when they stood at those buildings? And occasionally you might see a photograph or a painting that really brings it all alive. So he's really kind of vividly in his own imagination, drawing our imagination into what it's like to go into this ghost town. Someone's road home. Make yourself up a cheering song of how someone, a cheering song, because it's not so cheering because it's a bit spooky, this place is. Someone's road home from work, this once was. Who may be just ahead of you on foot or creaking with a buggy load of grain. The height of the adventure is the height of country where two village cultures faded into each other. Both of them are lost. And if you're lost enough to find yourself by now, pull in your ladder road behind you and put a sign up closed to all but me. Now that's become really psychic at this moment, psychological at this moment. If you're lost enough to find yourself by now, pull in your ladder road behind you and put a sign up, closed to all but me, then make yourself at home. This poem is called Directive. This poem is kind of directing us in imagination to go to a place that's completely emptied of all its previous occupants, and then roll up the road behind you and put a sign up, closed to all but me, make yourself at home. That's the kind of the core of what's happening in this poem. Let's see how it resolves itself, if it does resolve itself. The only field now left's no bigger than a harness gall. Well, a harness gall is a sore on a horse's skin, so there's no fields left there. First, there's the children's house of make-believe. Some shattered dishes underneath a pine, the playthings in the playhouse of the children. Weep for what little things could make them glad. Then for the house that is no more a house, but only a belilaced or belilacked cellar hole, now slowly closing like a dent in dough. Some of you, I'm sure, probably all of you have made bread and made dough. And you know, when you put a hole in dough at the top, gradually it closes up. The hole closes up with the wet dough. So there's been a house here, and the hole where the house was is gradually closing up like a dent in dough. Everything disappears completely. This was no playhouse, but a house in earnest. Your destination and your destinies, a brook that was the water of the house, cold as a spring, as yet so near its source, too lofty and original to rage. So your destination and your destinies, a brook that was the water of the house. So he's drawing our attention now to some kind of life-giving force next to this house. What is the destiny of this poem? We know the valley streams that, when aroused, will leave their tatters hung on barb and thorn. So some valley streams are incredibly strong. When they're aroused, they, you know, leave their force on thorns and barbs. That everything is in their wake. It shows how strong they've been. Look how the poem ends now. I have kept hidden in the instep arch of an old cedar at the waterside a broken drinking goblet like the Grail. So he's actually, it seems to me, talking about an actual place that he knew, that he's returned to, and he remembers having left a cup near the water, near where this house that's extinguished is. I've kept hidden in the instep arch of an old cedar at the waterside a broken drinking goblet like the Grail. And the Grail is the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper, and according to legend, the Grail later disappeared from its keepers because of their moral impurity, and various knights, including those of King Arthur's Round Table, went in quest of it. From this, the quest for the Grail has come to symbolize any spiritual search. So he's come back to find this drinking goblet, which in his imagination is like the Grail. Under a spell, so the wrong ones can't find it. So he imagined that when he put it there, he put a spell on it that no wrong people would find it. So can't get saved, as St. Mark says they mustn't. What does that mean, as St. Mark says they mustn't? If you look in St. Mark, in chapter 4, verse 12, Jesus is talking about the nature and the purpose of parables. And Jesus says, unto you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. This is to his apostles. But unto them that are without, all these things are done in parables, that seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest at any time they should be converted and their sins should be forgiven them. Very mysterious saying about the nature of parables, that they're only spoken for those that can hear and understand them, and those people that can't understand them, well, they're left out altogether. And Robert Frost, for all his lack of explicit religious connection alludes here to the fact that he's left this goblet by the river, hoping that no one will find it. None of the wrong people will find it, because he doesn't want them to find it, because he doesn't want them to get saved, as St. Mark says they mustn't get saved. So he's obviously alluding to, you know, people who've got no sense of the sacredness of this place, no connection with it, no sense of its history. You'll find this mug and break it and smash it or something and have no real valuation of it. Frost says in the third last line, "I stole the goblet from the children's playhouse." So he has that memory. And the last two lines, again with an echo from the Gospels, "Here are your waters and your watering place. Drink and be whole again beyond confusion." So this is the journey that Robert Frost has taken us on. And it's a journey that seems to take him back to something very significant and important in his own childhood. But more than that, it's kind of taking us into the unknown, but taking us to a very privileged place in the unknown where we can recognize the value of moving away from our own certainties. It would bear a lot more discussion, that poem would. "The height of the adventure is the height of country where two village cultures faded into each other. Both of them are lost. And if you're lost enough to find yourself, by now pull in your ladder road behind you and put a sign up, close to all but me, then make yourself at home." I think a lot of Robert Frost's poem is doing just that. It's taking us beyond our comfort zone into an area where we have to reflect at the, you know, mysterious aspects of experience, sometimes the horrific aspects of experience. Just want to finish Robert Frost here, and I've got more poems to look at. These are poems that seem on the surface to be about mundane events, but that evoke a sense of the ineffable, even a sense of the sacred. They're like "Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening." Each of those poems is really worth reading, especially after apple picking, and the beautiful short poem, "The Pasture." We've looked at that one. Poems that dramatize human affairs, often with a focus on death. It's very preoccupied with death at times. And they're poems that really shock you, or can shock you. So there's this poem, "Out, Out." "The buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard." Any of you been out to where they cut wood out in around northern New South Wales, those huge forest areas where you have big wood logging factories where you hear the saws snarling all day long up around Bulladela, that part of the world? Any of you know that part of the world? Go up there and get out of the car and you'll hear buzzing and snarling of saws all the time. "The buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard and made dust and dropped stove-length sticks of wood. Sweet-scented stuff when the breeze drew across it. And from there, those that lifted eyes could count 5 mountain ranges, one behind the other, under the sunset far into Vermont." Wonderfully graphic described scene, of landscape scene, as a backdrop to this activity of the cutting of the lengths of wood. "And the saw snarled and rattled, as it ran light or had to bear a load." Rattles when it ran light, or snarled when it was cutting through timber. "And nothing happened. Day was all but done. Call it a day, I wish they might have said, to please the boy by giving him the half hour that a boy counts so much when saved from work. His sister stood beside them in her apron to tell them, 'Supper!' At the word, the saw, as if to prove saws knew what supper meant, leapt out at the boy's hand, or seemed to leap, he must have given the hand. However it was, neither refused the meeting. But the hand, the boy's first outcry was a rueful laugh as he swung toward them, holding up the hand, half in appeal, but half as if to keep the life from spilling. Then the boy saw all, since he was old enough to know, big boy, doing a man's work, though a child at heart. He saw all spoilt. "Don't let him cut my hand off, the doctor, when he comes. Don't let him, sister." So, but the hand was gone already. The doctor put him in the dark of ether. He lay and puffed his lips out with his breath. And then the watcher at his pulse took fright. No one believed. They listened at his heart. Little, less, nothing. And that ended it. No more to build on there. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. Out, Out is the title from Shakespeare's Macbeth. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow. And if you read the other poems, they're really worth, you know, just sitting down and reading, even read them aloud to somebody you know. They're just fantastic little dramas, like Home Burial, for example, where a wife is sitting at the top of the stairs and she's looking over her shoulder through a window of the house, and the husband's at the bottom of the stairs and saying, "What are you looking at?" And she turns around and she doesn't want to say anything. And he goes up and has a look, and he looks out through the window and he sees that she's looking at the graveyard where they buried her first child. And as the thing unfolds, she explodes about how she feels he had no feeling for that event, how he just went in there and dug the grave with no real feeling and understanding for the event. And then there's another incredible poem here, The Death of the Hired Man. Husband and wife again. This man they hired last season suddenly appears, and the wife wants to tell the husband, "Silas is back." And the husband says, "Well, bugger Silas, he can be looked after by his brother down the road." And there's this argument that takes place about what happened last year and how their son was involved and what have you. I'm not going to tell you how it ends. It's amazing. Very readable, very dramatic, and yet all, you know, contained within kind of a wonderful rhythmic structure that really brings it to life. Okay, I better move on to Robert Lowell because he's not going to get his Guernsey. Political anti-war poetry. Well, I've talked about Memories of West Street in Lepke. Let's have a little listen. There's one little clip I found of Robert Lowell actually talking about and reading about West Street in Lepke. Now, this is on your page. Page 316. And this poem is a confessional poem in the sense that it tells us very much about what Lowell went through when he was a conscientious objector. You know, the judge at his trial accused him of letting his family tradition down. Imagine that, the judge saying, "You've left your family tradition down. Your father was in the military service and you are just an idiot, blah, blah, blah." And he was put into jail, a pretty horrible jail, for a year with the most hardened criminals. So let's see if I can get this film to happen. I've got to find the spot as well. I'll just put it on silent for a moment.
Spirit mad, Mussolini unfurled the eagle of Caesar. He was one of us.
Only your foes. I envy the conspicuous waste of our grandparents on their grand tours.
We're not there yet.
Long-haired Victorian sages accepted the universe. while breathing on their trust funds through the world.
The poem has an almost loony tone quality, and it begins to have something that Lowell brilliantly had for the rest of his career, the ability to take stuff out of the newspapers, out of the headlines, set it down in the context of other things that they're not a kind of symbol out of the most bizarre dailiness.
Bombastic Mussolini, the sawdust Caesar, comes to his end in the gutter. He led his country to ruin when he threw his lot in with Hitler. A fitting climax to a life of treachery and double cross.
When the Vatican made marriage to Assumption dogma, the crowds of San Pietro screamed Papa. The Holy Father dropped his looking glass and listened. His electric razor purred, and his canary chirped on his left hand. Lights of science couldn't hold a candle to Mary risen. At one miraculous stroke, angel winged, gorgeous as a jungle bird. But who believed this? Who could understand?
Not quite there yet.
Pilgrim still kissed St. Peter's brazen sandal. The Duce's lynched, bare-booted skull still spoke. God herded his people to the coup de grace. The costumed Switzers spoke their pikes to push, all passed through the monstrous human crush.
Life Studies was a watershed book for Lowell. His early poems got a very concentrated, very inward. In Life Studies, he adopted a much more conversational, freer style, the so-called, I hate the word, confessional style. But of course, it was the result of his having worked for 3 or 4 years on his autobiography and going over his past, his childhood, his parents.
Lowell early wrote poems about knocking his father down, the one poem that appears in Lord Wirrie's Castle. And this sense of rebellion figures in a great number of poems, not only regarding his own actual father, but in all paternal figures, in all authority figures, in sending a letter to the President of the United States announcing that he would not fight in the war. There are other less demonstrative and less self-aggrandizing ways of refusing to fight.
The time when Churchill and Roosevelt met and said that tender burn something in ruthless to destroy, and we're saturating Hamburg and the northern German cities, the civilian population, and they announced their policy of unconditional surrender. Well, then it seemed to me we were doing just what our Germans were doing. And I was a Roman Catholic at the time, and we had a very complicated idea of war. It's called the unjust war, which is impossible to define. But it's obvious the possibility that between two kinds of wars.
This is Lowell speaking now.
The other, this seemed to me clearly unjust. So I refused to go to the army and was sent to jail. I went to something I think is called the West Street Jail in New York, a sort of clearinghouse. It had all kinds of people, two sort of labor pimps, Bioff and Brown, very powerful people who leave the jail every day with their lawyers. But the most famous inmate was Louis Lepke, who was head of Murder Incorporated. And it did just that. You paid Murder Incorporated something and people would disappear forever.
Poems are always about two things. They're about whatever they're about, and they're about language.
Okay. That's enough, Dave. A little taste of Lowell himself. Let's have a look at this poem, Memories of West Street and Lepke, on page 317. So it begins really describing his own domestic situation, as a lot of the confessional poems do. Each one of these confessional poems, like, for instance, My Last Afternoon with Uncle Devereux, Winslow, home after 3 months away, memories of West Street and Lepke, skunk hour, night sweat, each one of these very graphic descriptions of his own personal domestic life, often feuds with his wife, often feeling terribly conscience-stricken about the fact that his little three-year-old daughter has to reconnect with him after he's been in a psychiatric institution for 12 months. And, you know, he's kind of brought to his knees again by the kind of factual realities of his daily life. So confessional is a really good word for describing what he's doing. In this poem, Memories of West Street and Lepke, he's, you know, not only reflecting on his personal life, but he's reflecting on the time that he went into jail, and he's reflecting on the inmates of the jail, and therefore giving a kind of a picture of the American social and political life at that time. Poem written in 1959. Only teaching on Tuesdays, bookworming in pyjamas fresh from the washer each morning. So he's out of work. I hog a whole house on Boston's hardly passionate Marlborough Street. He's feeling guilty about where he lives, and he's living in one of the most wealthy parts of Boston, where even the man scavenging filth in the back alley trash cans has two children, a beach wagon, a helpmate, and is a young Republican. I have a 9 months daughter young enough to be my granddaughter. Like the sun, she rises in her flame flamingo infant's wear. A wonderful line that is. Notice the free verse. It's not rhythmical quite in the same way as Robert Frost is. But when you analyze this poetry, you can see there that the line lengths are very carefully created to position each of the, you know, the key ideas one against the other. And the sun rises, the 9 months old daughter, this image of her like the sun rising in her flame flamingo infant's wear, you know, is both an image of domestic beauty, but also a celebration, but also in contrast to what comes, a rather a savage contrast. These are the tranquilized 50s, and I am 40. In the 50s in America was the time of McCarthyism and suppression and political, great deal of political control. Ought I to regret my seed time? I was a fire-breathing Catholic CO, conscientious objector, and made my manic statement, telling off the state and president, and then sat waiting sentence in the bullpen beside a Negro boy with curlicues of marijuana in his hair. Given a year, I walked on the roof of the West Street Jail, a short enclosure like my school soccer court, and saw the Hudson River once a day through sooty clothesline entanglements and bleaching khaki tenements. Strolling, I yammered metaphysics with Abramovitz, a jaundice yellow, it's really tan, and flyweight pacifist. So vegetarian, he wore rope shoes and preferred fallen fruit. So you meet some weird characters in jail. He tried to convert Bioff and Brown. Bioff and Brown are documented famous New York criminals at the time. He tried to convert Bioff and Brown, the Hollywood pimps, to his diet. Hairy, muscular suburban, wearing chocolate double-breasted suits, they blew their tops and beat him black and blue. A very powerful kind of dramatic evocation of his life in the prison at the time. I was so out of things, I'd never heard of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Are you a CO? I asked a fellow jailbird. No, he answered, I'm a JW, Jehovah's Witness. He taught me the hospital tuck, and pointed out the t-shirted back of Murder Incorporated Tsar Lepke, there piling towels on a rack, or dawdling off to his little segregated cell full of things forbidden the common man. A portable radio, a dresser, two toy American flags tied together with a ribbon of Easter palm. Tsar Lepke, you can look him up, Lepke, one of the most famous criminals. He was eventually electrocuted in Sing Sing Jail, which is about 30 miles north of New York. I think he was the last person executed there, but it's also said that he had a lobotomy before he was executed. Pictures of him on the internet, I don't have any here, but he looks a kind of a well-dressed man with a hat, and he was in charge of multiple murders all through New York. When they finally caught him, they really thought they'd done something wonderful. But in jail, because he was on death row, he had his own private cell full of forbidden things forbidden to the common man. Flabby, bald, lobotomized, he drifted in a sheepish calm, where no agonizing reappraisal jarred his concentration on the electric chair, hanging like an oasis in his air of lost connections. His air of lost connections. So a portrait here of someone who's got right out of the system on his way to the electric chair, and Lowell's own kind of personal involvement in that event. Skunk Hour, Night Sweat, horrific poems about Lowell's own psychological fragmentation, his own complete kind of loss of control, it seems. In Skunk Hour, comparing his own voyeurism against the seemingly purposeful activity of skunks who, you know, go around the streets at night, emptying all the trash cans and making the place stink to hell. I want to turn to For the Union Dead. Now, what else have I got here? Just to look through these, what I'm trying to say here. I was going to look briefly at the early poetry. Densely textured, very opaque. You know, just one example compared to what I've just read here on page 309. This is from the Quaker graveyard at Nantucket. When the whale's viscera go and roll, and the roll of its corruption overruns this world beyond tree-swept Nantucket and Woods Hole, and Martha's Vineyard, sailor, will your sword whistle and fall and sink into the fat in the great ash pit of Jehoshaphat? The bones cry for the blood of the white whale, the fat flukes arch and whack about its ears, the death lance churns into the sanctuary tears, the gun blue swingle heaving like a flail and hacks the coiling life out. It works and drags and rips the sperm whale's midriff into rags. Very, you know, almost Elizabethan in the density of its language, in the density of its rhythm, something like John Donne almost. Quite a lot of his poetry in the anthology there, you've got three of them I've listed there. And then in 1959 he began his confessional poetry that I've mentioned, and there are the confessional poems that we have. But we come to this last poem, For the Union Dead, which, you know, has quite a few connections with what we've been doing last week in particular. And I've given you also, I think I've given you that link where you can hear Robert Lowell reading For the Union Dead. And what you've got on the screen there is actually the statue that was built in Boston for this Colonel Shaw, who led the first all African American regiment in the Union Army. And this bronze relief was done by the sculptor August St. Gaudens. It was dedicated in 1897 and stands in the Boston Commons. And it's got an inscription on it, which is the which says, Omnia reliquit servare rem publicam, which means he leaves all behind to save the Republic. But Lowell has actually changed that to relinquunt omnia servare rem republicam, which means they give up everything to save the Republic. So it's turned it around from Robert Gould Shaw to the black Africans who were part of that. And there's this wonderful painting, there it is, look. Colonel Shaw and the Massachusetts 54th storming Fort Wagner, and there is Robert Gould Shaw in the middle being shot, and if you look carefully you'll see that all those blue soldiers are black soldiers, and they were all defeated in this particular battle, and Robert Shaw was buried there by the Confederates. There's a quotation on the back of this plaque, which reads, it's on the bottom of the screen there, the white officers taking life and honour in their hands, cast in their lot with men of a despised race, unproven in war, and risk death as inciters of servile insurrection if taken prisoners, besides encountering all the common perils of camp, march and battle. The black rank and the file volunteered when disaster clouded the Union cause. Served without pay for 18 months till given that of a white troops. Faced threatened enslavement if captured. Were brave in action, patient under heavy and dangerous labours, and cheerful amid hardships and privations. Together they gave to the nation and the world undying proof that Americans of African descent possess the pride, courage and devotion of the patriot soldier. 180,000 such Americans enlisted under the Union flag. And it's that that Robert Lowell is really kind of objecting to. The fact that all this was said about these soldiers. But what has happened since that time? And, you know, in the second last stanza on page 321, Lowell says, "When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro schoolchildren rise like balloons." You know, an image which the footnote suggests is probably news photographs connected with contemporary civil rights demonstrations to secure desegregation of schools in the South. So, you know, civil war came, but segregation was still very strong and active after the removal of slavery. And so this poem takes us well beyond confessional poetry. But again, it begins with allusions to Lowell's own childhood and experience of Boston when he was a child. He remembers being in Boston, and there was a big aquarium in Boston, and he remembers as a child pushing his nose up against that aquarium and looking at the fish moving up and down. But he's back there now, and the aquarium has been demolished. The poem was written in 1960. The aquarium was demolished in the early 1950s. And what he sees in Boston, he sees what we're seeing around Sydney now, a lot of, certainly around my suburb, houses falling down and diggers digging up the ground and putting in new apartments, everything changing for the better, right? Who knows? So he's conscious of this change. And yet this statue is, this engraving, it's like a statue, it is an engraving, still stands firm in the middle of the town. But the poem is raising questions about our relationship to the African Americans and his own feelings about it. And in tutorials, we're going to see if you can make sense of the last two stanzas. So I'm going to read this poem now, make a few comments as we go through, and then I'm going to let you go. So let's go. "For the Union Dead. The old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now. Its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weather-vane cod has lost half its scales. The airy tanks are dry." So, what's that an image of? Neglect. Sorry, what?
Neglect.
Neglect. Good, nice. Everything disintegrating. "Once my nose crawled like a snail on the glass, as young children might do. My hand tingled to burst the bubbles drifting from the noses of the cowed, compliant fish, as we all did up against an aquarium when we were 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years old. My hand draws back. My hand draws back," and of course that's now, you know, both memory of what he did, but it's also now metaphorically drawing his back from the memory of that past time because things have changed so much. "My hand draws back. I often sigh still for the dark, downward and vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile." So something's lost. Something's lost. He sighs for the dark, downward, vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile. Something has been uprooted. Something is gone, even though it was kind of a dark, attractive thing. Something has disappeared. "One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence on the Boston Common." So what has the aquarium been replaced with? What's it being replaced with? Adam. Not quite. One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence on the Boston Common. Behind their cage, yellow dinosaur steam shovels were grunting as they cropped up tons of mush and grass to gouge their underworld garage. What's he seeing? Excavation. Minty for Amy. Parking spaces luxuriate like civic sand piles in the heart of Boston. A girdle of orange, Puritan pumpkin-coloured girders braces the tingling state house. Shaking over the excavations, now we come to the point, as it faces Colonel Shaw and his bell-cheeked Negro infantry on St. Gordon's shaking Civil War relief, propped by a plank splint against the garage's earthquake. What kind of care and concern and is being taken of this memorial? Not a lot. 2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James is the brother of Henry James, the novelist, American novelist. William James himself was a great intellect at the time. He wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, but he was obviously, it seems like he was there at the dedication of this statue. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze Negroes breathe. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Why? Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. What's it like when you've got a fishbone stuck in your throat?
Very uncomfortable.
Very. Who is this uncomfortable to? Anyway, there's a question. Who is it uncomfortable to, this thing that's having to be propped up and standing in the way of excavating for a car park? Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its colonel, that's the chap in the middle on the horse, is as lean as a compass needle. Interesting metaphor, simile rather. Is as lean as a compass needle. What connotations does that have about the colonel? He has an angry wren-like vigilance, a greyhound's gentle tautness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy. Telling us about this Robert Gould Shaw, the general. He is out of bounds now. Why is he out of bounds now? But more immediately, in terms of what's happening in the city, he's behind a fence. He's there in an area where there's excavation taking place. He's out of bounds now. He rejoices in man's lovely peculiar power to choose life and die. When he leads his black soldiers to death, he cannot bend his back. Something very ironic in that stanza. On a thousand small town, New England, Greens, the old white churches hold their air of sparse, sincere rebellion. Frayed flags quilt the graveyards of the Grand Army of the Republic. Frayed flags. What's this saying about American memory of connection with the ideology of freeing slaves from slavery, going to war? Don't answer the question, but the stone statues of the abstract Union soldier, because the abstract Union soldier, there are statues of the Union soldier in many, many towns in New England. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. Wasp-waisted, they doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. It's a little bit like those statues outside the New South Wales Art Gallery. I don't know if you've ever noticed those two big statues that celebrate and commemorate war and soldiers in war. Nobody ever notices them. About 4 years ago, there was a Japanese-American artist out here who worked with the man who put material all over, what's his name? Covered the whole of Middle Harbour with material and so on. Can't remember his name. Remember his name? The artist who wrapped up big things. What's his name? You know I'm talking about. Anyway, this artist took those, I wish you'd seen it, some of you may have seen it, he took these two big statues to war and placed them inside buildings, temporary buildings, and you walked inside, and in one of them, the big horse outside the gallery, there's a horse with its foot like this and there's a soldier on top of it. He constructed it so when you went inside this building, the horse was actually on a double bed in a suburban bedroom. And in the other one, the horse's head was in a room where there was a TV. He completely defamiliarized it, and he made the point. He turned these statues of war into showing how the incredibly destructive impact that these things had on, you know, residential occupation in Australia. It was fantastic. So what you're getting here is Robert Lowell looking at... Yes, David?
It's Christo and Jean-Claude.
Christo. And John who?
Jean-Claude.
Jean-Claude. Thank you. That's it. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. Wasp-waisted, they doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch where his son's body was thrown, right there nearly, and lost with his niggers. The ditch is nearer. There are no statues for the last war here. On Boylston Street, a commercial photograph shows Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler safe, the rock of ages that survived the blast. What's Lowell doing by telling us that the only picture of Hiroshima is being used by an advertisement company to sell safes? Lowell is saying something very, very interesting and important here about America's attitude to war. Space is nearer. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro school children rise like balloons. And here's the two stanzas you're going to have to wrestle with in your tutorial. Colonel Shaw is riding on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break. The aquarium is gone. Everywhere giant finned cars now nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on Greece. Thank you. See you in tutorials.